Lane with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State. Today we have a very special program to you. For you, it's going to be a call-in show with discussion about the multi-part series that we have had over the past several weeks, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State. The number to call is 209-209-2800, I believe. We'll have to have Michael
type in
with the right number.
Yes, that would be 2900. You said it right the first time.
Okay, 209-2900. Prepare to call us with your questions about the series that we've been broadcasting over the past several weeks. Ralph?
Yes, we're going to be discussing particularly aspects of the relationship between Michael Mukasey and Rudy Giuliani that, as the Washington Post described it on September 18th, ties that go back decades, ties that involve the recent proposal by Giuliani to have Israel made a member of NATO and for the United States to be obligated to engage in war wherever whenever Israel is involved in military conflict, namely to immediately weigh in. This is a process that has been related to the category of terror, of course, and in particular the plans for an attack on Iran. So, brothers and sisters, you've heard a series that has attempted to address what we call the architecture of the fascist state in preparation. And no one has been more upfront about the dismantling of normal and nominal constitutional protections in the United States than the nominee for Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, with support by the Democratic Party and, of course, from Bush himself. The statement by Charles Schumer, the New York senator, was that the Democratic Party was solidly behind Mukasey, and if Mukasey were the nominee, Schumer undertook, and along with Patrick Leahy of Vermont, to drop any investigation into the functioning of Gonzales as Attorney General with respect to the special prosecutors and the illegal and unconstitutional intervention by the Attorney General in removing prosecutors who were independent of the Bush administration's control.
Ralph, aside from the issue of the Michael Mukasey nomination, over the past weeks we discussed the executive privilege claimed by the president, which creates a virtual dictatorship for the presidency. And as well, we discussed the trial of Jose Padilla and the implications of that trial for each and every one of us in the United States. But let's go back to what Ralph was saying about Michael Mukasey. And in particular, we focused last week on an article, an opinion piece that was written by Mukasey himself, published in the Wall Street Journal, September 18th, 2007. Because in this important piece that we think you should look at, Michael Mukasey suggests that the government set up
a parallel judicial system, what he calls an adjudicatory framework, that would be entirely parallel and secondary to the normal constitutional protections, in which anyone who was charged with an offense affecting national security would be treated as are the mentally ill, namely people who are committed to mental institutions and considered and deemed to be incompetent and incapable of defending themselves and consequently denied access to attorneys and any of these normal protections.
And thanks, Ralph, because the article to which I was referring is not Mukasey's actual opinion piece that was published in the Wall Street Journal. September 18, 2007 is the Wall Street Journal's opinion, their editorial position in support of Mukasey, and they consider him the right man for the job. For instance, they say he stood at the center of tough legal issues, and they point in particular to his sitting as the judge in the Landmarks case, that is the trial of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman and other defendants, in which he, they said he was got his lessons in how to deal with terror. Ralph?
Yes, it was what they call the defining issue for him. But, of course, what they obscure is that it was not merely a defining issue. It was Mukasey that defined the issue. Because as the Wall Street Journal describes it in the article called the Mukasey nomination that you cite, Maya, when he presided over the 1995 trial of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, he deemed it improper for the defense to be allowed to summon witnesses that would who would establish that the Sheikh had been framed. He did not allow the defense to summon witnesses, including the former Attorney General of the United States, Janet Reno, and the then Senator from New York, Alphonse D'Amato, who could have established and could have, under examination by the defense counsel, been made to concede that the event of 1993 in the Landmarks case was an inside job. And the process through which Mukasey denied the right to make these, for the defense to make these calls for witnesses, included an acknowledgement by Mukasey that the figure who was the unsung, I won't call him hero, but architect of both the 1993 bombing and of the Landmarks case was none other than Ali Mohammed, who is a person who worked for the CIA, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and out of Fort Bragg, something that Mukasey actually acknowledges. And in acknowledging it, out of hearing of the jury, this judge decided that the prosecution would have full access to Ali Mohammed, but the defense was denied access to Ali Mohammed on national security grounds. As the partner of William Kunstler, Ronald Kuby, described Mukasey, he was the second prosecutor in black robes, with the skills and the determination to destroy any evidentiary basis for a fair trial.
And Ralph, he's also a judge who sits on the bench, and for people in New York are probably aware, he was the chief judge in the New York courts. And when he was the judge in New York, at the time when Jose Padilla was taken by the government and held and was to be declared an enemy combatant, before there was any evidence against Jose Padilla, Judge Mukasey had said in his June 9th order that Padilla, quote, is a continuing present and grave danger to national security of the United States, and that his detention, quote, is necessary to prevent him from siding with al-Qaeda in its efforts to attack the United States, end quote. So here you have a judge sitting on the bench and ruling before there has been any trial, any evidence, anything that would claim to presented to show that a person is guilty, and he is calling that person a grave threat to the grave danger to the people of the United States. And that is why you have the Wall Street Journal in its editorial saying, quote, you finally have the right man for the right job at the right time, end quote. Ralph?
They add something to that, Maya. This is the Wall Street Journal instructing Congress. He says, the Wall Street Journal writes, you have the right man for the right job at the right time. Try not to screw this one up. That is the review and outlook editorial commentary of the Wall Street Journal. And the right man for the right job, Maya, with respect to Jose Padilla, declaimed that Jose Padilla would be responsible for the deaths of untold tens of thousands of people through the release of radiological dirty bombs across the United States. Now, Not only has there never been a scintilla of evidence for this, but when the government was actually obliged to go into civil court, they dropped all those charges because they would have had to produce evidence to sustain them. There has never been any evidence advanced by the government for this charge designed to terrorize the American people and to whipsaw them into accepting, in the case of Jose Padilla, a condition in which Judge Mukasey determined that the defense lawyer, I want to emphasize, as we did last week, Mukasey disagreed with the Bush administration about denying an enemy combatant, although an American citizen like Padilla, the right even to have an attorney. No, he said, let him have an attorney, and then the defense counsel will be denied any access to anything pertaining to the treatment of Padilla or the evidence against him on the grounds that this would violate national security. So what, and the New York Times has actually supported that position of Mukasey, which means the following. They want to institutionalize the deprivation of all rights for people who are deemed national security threats or enemy combatants or what have you, by allowing them counsel and then emasculating counsel. Counsel is to be treated as an enemy combatant itself. Counsel for the accused is to be deprived of any information so that you have, in effect, show trials. You have the form of trial without the adversary procedure. And beyond that, the judge determined that no reference to the treatment of Padilla would be allowed to be mentioned in the court room itself. The jury was not allowed to know that this man had been held for 3.5 years in a Navy brig where he was tortured so savagely with total sensory deprivation and mind-altering drugs that he had lost his mind.
Right, Ralph, that's later in the Florida trial, that judge also. So we have judges in collaboration with the fascist nature of this state. That's why we call it the architecture of the fascist state. Again, let me repeat the phone number, 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. Please telephone us with your questions, as I know many of you have had and written to us with your questions about this multi-part series, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State. As you may have heard, Ralph and I are in two separate places at the moment, and we depend on our wonderful engineer, Michael G. Haskins, to let us know when your calls are coming through. Michael?
Yes, we're ready.
Okay, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Ralph and Maya.
Hello.
You guys are national treasures. Loose Change, second edition. And it just reminds me of something that I believe it was Hitler said. He says, it's much easier to get the masses of people to believe a big lie than a little one. It's very interesting that his truth is our reality. The series that you just recently doing is just so right on point. I want to connect it. Pardon me. I want to connect it to his close, intimate, almost ties with Giuliani. And it's no surprise to me to hear that he was, I guess, at the Southern District of New York, because doing community radio and public access here, I was documenting that the court, the family court, the Supreme Court, the surrogate court, were being used the way that we're seeing now in terms of kangaroo courts, because Giuliani was doing such terror and torture in sort of a pre-gentrification where they were using protective services for adults to literally kidnap with the police people of color, elders, their aunts, their uncles, their parents, and literally murdering them in hospitals and nursing homes. And
excuse me, do you have a question?
Yes, and with the foster care children, too. I want to ask you, Mike Gravel was on the NewsHour last night, and he's doing a national initiative in terms of the people being the fourth branch of government and literally making legislation. And, you know, I would like to get your ideas first on what you think about and whether you're familiar with, you know, just taking this whole structure down. And that's exactly what he talked of. And the second part of the question is, when are you going to talk or do a report about the microbiologists that have sustained very suspicious and very high deaths and or murders? And I love you guys. Keep up the good work, and I'll listen over the air to your responses.
Thank you so much, Sister, for the question.
Thank you for your questions. Oh, I'm sorry, Ralph, I didn't hear you. But we did address the microbiologists. I'll get to the simple part first. Several years ago, I guess it is now, we've been on for 6 years and we've covered so many subjects, but we did address the issue of the suspicious
death. We did an 8-part series on Forging the Next Pandemic, which addressed exactly the issue of the militarization, the weaponization of biological agents and of viral agents, and the enormous effort that's been made by the U.S. government, its intelligence agencies, and military to alter the genome of pandemic agents, viral agents, such as the cause of the great influenza of World War I that murdered or that killed up to 50 million people. And they have, as it were, resurrected the viral agent, and they've altered its genome so as to allow no immune response. And that process of taking the most virulent viral agents and modifying them so that there is no known immune response to them has been, with respect to SARS, it's been with respect to West Nile virus, it's been with respect to the Ebola virus, the most horrendous pandemic viruses, and many of the microbiologists involved in this work have been dying in rapid succession, and that was part of what we were documenting as well in this 8-part series. To address the question of the terror attacks of September 11th, of course, and what we were discussing with regard to Mukasey and the dismantling of democratic rights in the United States. Of course, the attacks of September 11th, like those of 1993, were, as we've tried to document over these 6 years and as many in the movement have done, part of a government operation designed to create a rationale and pretext for permanent and preemptive war and for repressive measures at home. It's a measure, as we'd like to argue and to demonstrate, of the crisis of capitalism, that it can no longer allow normal democratic processes, that it has to remove the formal facade of democratic rights in the process of waging its class war at home and abroad. And that certainly bears upon the relationship of Giuliani, Rudolph Giuliani, and to Mukasey. And as I began earlier to cite the Washington Post article of September 18th, it's a tie that goes back decades, goes back to the 1970s, actually. But in 1985, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Rudolph Giuliani, was undertaking mass trials, holding defendants without bail, and subpoenaing defense lawyers to testify at their clients' grand jury hearings, which literally to testify against their own clients in a violation of client confidentiality. It was Michael Mukasey who gave a strongly worded opinion that Giuliani's tactics were entirely justified, and he said that the enemies of the United States were far more dangerous and powerful than the critics of these methods were willing to acknowledge. And that has been the platform on the basis of which Giuliani and Mukasey have operated together. He is a financial contributor to Giuliani's presidential campaign, as he is to Joseph Lieberman. They are ardently supportive of the Likud wing of the Zionist state. They are deeply implicated in the terror plots of 93 and of September 11th, insofar as the role of Mukasey has been to frame the Sheikh for the bombing in 93 and as well for the Landmarks case, and to conceal the evidence of government involvement from the jury, although extraordinarily, from our perspective, openly acknowledging the role of Ali Mohammed in his own statements. Mukasey and Giuliani are, as the New York, as the Washington Post says, two people who are extremely close, extremely, extremely close, and everybody knows that. They're quoting New York Assemblyman Dove Hicken, the Brooklyn Democrat, and also an ardent supporter of the Likud. That's the underlying politics that go to the role of the Mossad, and along with U.S. imperialism in creating the events of September 11th. And much of this assault upon democratic rights, the call by Mukasey for a separate judicial system that would apply to those accused of jeopardizing national security. In the Wall Street Journal, Mukasey actually states that unless Congress does this, creates a separate system. And in the course of that article and that statement, Mukasey actually stated that the Ten Amendments, the first Ten Amendments, the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, are a secondary and ancillary part of the Constitution whose main thrust is to allow the executive the unfettered right to protect the United States and its citizens during from attack. So the entire apparatus of process of democratic procedure is to be scrapped under the open declared plan of Mukasey. One other last point I want to mention about his relationship to Giuliani. When Giuliani was unleashing the police in basically terror attacks upon Black and Latino citizens across the United States, when cops were shooting down people in cold blood, 50 and 70 shots at a time, when people were being yanked off the street by plainclothesmen and brutalized, shot, tased, beaten to a pulp, and when the judge, to adjudicate cases of this nature, he enunciated a principle, which is that the benefit of the doubt must always go to the police and to the prosecution.
Or Ralph, that is, excuse me, I was going to say that that is very evident from a front page story that appeared in the New York Times Monday, September 24th, post-9/11 cases fuel criticism for nominee. And it's a story, a lengthy story, that refers to a situation that came before Judge Michael Mukasey in Federal District Court in Manhattan on October 2nd, 2001. The case of Osama Abdallah, who was rounded up, as many Pakistani and Arab men were in the days after the September 11th attacks, thousands of them. And for Abdallah, it was as a so-called potential witness in a terrorism investigation. And when Abdallah's attorney, who flew in from San Diego, pointed to the fact that Abdallah had been beaten by the police, that he had bruises that were hidden beneath his orange prison jumpsuit, Judge Mukasey said, as far as the claim that he was beaten, I will tell you that he looks fine to me. And he refused to have him examined, as Abdallah later was in the prison, and it was confirmed that he had been beaten by the police. Also, Abdallah spent, I think it was 5 years in prison. They refused to let him out on bail, and then he was released without any conviction whatsoever. So this is Judge Mukasey, especially, as you say, giving not just the prosecutor and the police, as you mentioned again, not just the benefit of the doubt, but supporting them all the way.
Maya, that one last point about this, and I would refer our caller and a comrade in this struggle to the article by Michael Cooper on September 19th in the New York Times, An Old Friend Joins Giuliani in the Spotlight. And it talks about the fact that the two lawyers have been associated together, their families as well, presiding at weddings and all the rest of it. Mukasey stating, "Know that my admiration and love for both of you is without limit," referring to Giuliani and his wife. Mukasey, who stands to lead the Justice Department, as the New York Times puts it, when prosecutors in the Southern District of New York are investigating a case with sensitive political implications for Giuliani, the issue is whether to seek an indictment of Giuliani's police commissioner and business partner, Bernard Kerik. And the implications of this are clear. Between Mukasey and Giuliani, the ties run deep, including financial. And it mentions the tens of thousands of dollars that Mukasey has been donating to Giuliani's presidential campaign. And it mentions that Tony Fratto, Deputy White House Press Secretary, stated that the White House counsel, Fred Feeling, called Mr. Giuliani on Sunday, 2 days after Mukasey had been offered the post of Attorney General, to inform him of the decision. And the interesting thing about this is, as the New York Times, and I'm going to jump ahead here, states, Mukasey upheld Giuliani's policy of allowing the police to seize the cars of people who were charged with something but not convicted of something. And indeed, at the time that Giuliani called for police officers accused of brutality or of shootings to be given the benefit of the doubt, in 2004, Judge Mukasey, in his defense of the USA Patriot Act in the Wall Street Journal, stated, with respect to Giuliani and all cases in which police were police conduct was being evaluated, the police and the authorities are to receive from this, from the citizens, the benefit of doubt. Translation, as I said a moment ago, and I'll conclude with this because there's much to say about this, but the meaning is that if you're testifying and a cop is testifying and you present evidence and the cop and it's contrary to what the cop states, the police are entitled to the benefit of the doubt, independent of the evidence. Police and the authorities with respect to national security matters. In reality, what this Wall Street Journal and New York Times orchestration of the views of Mukasey and of Giuliani are preparing us for is show trials, the absence of any pretense at democratic entitlement or the right of defense or fair trial or of evidence being allowed to be weighed by a jury.
Before we go to our next question from our listeners, I'd like to remind you that you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial in New York and in the tri-state area. Michael, is there another? Michael?
Yes, Maya, in fact, yes. There are a couple of other callers, and thank you for IDing the station right at the bottom of the hour. WBAI New York at 99.5 FM. This is Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen taking your phone calls. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hello, brother.
Welcome to WBAI Airways.
Thank you, Ralph and Maya, and for this rare opportunity to speak with you. I'll try to make this question comprehensible. I believe both you, so this question is directed to both Ralph and or Maya. You have used the term in your recent series and prior neoconservative and on occasion neoliberal. And of course, I've heard both of those terms all over the media, all over the place. But when I hear someone define, after using the term neoconservative, and therefore they do this, this, and that, and someone using the term, not used as often, but used frequently, neoliberal, and they do this, this, and that, it sounds like the exact same thing. So my question to one or both of you is, if you would please, in your own words, describe as taking as long or short of time as you want to, because I don't think I can be the only person puzzled out here, what is the definition or what are the primary attributes of someone who would be considered a neoconservative vis-a-vis a neoliberal?
That's a very good question. And, Ralph, these are specific words should have specific use, and we try to adhere to that. Ralph?
Well, look, the category neoconservative...
I'll listen off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for the question.
Calling.
And I'm glad you raised that issue because these labels are really basically political jargon describing the tactics that are debated between varying political supporters of the capitalist state and its hegemony. Neocons are those who are from the so-called conservative tradition, i.e., those who are opposed to any form of social services for the population at large, those who give uncritical support to the military and intelligence coercion. Namely that of the war on terror and support for the Israeli state. The American Enterprise Institute, the people who have been the authors PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, the people who have called for a permanent preemptive war on 60 countries, from John Bolton to Michael Woolsey to the Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and people associated with the American Standard and with William Kristol and this whole proto-Zionist virtual operatives of the Likud wing of the Israeli state are associated with the use of the category of terror as the rationale for U.S. militarism and U.S. imperialism abroad. They're very intimately bound up not only with the events of the September 11th, but with the entire agenda of the Patriot Act and so on. The issue that we've attempted to address when we've looked at the role of the neocons and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, JINSA, that Jason Invest wrote about in The Nation, the programming that we've done over the years about the role of the neocons in this entire operation of permanent war, of dismantling each Middle Eastern and Central Asian country into its ethnic and religious components. One of the things that we've tried to do as well is to demonstrate that what are now called neocons were rooted in the Democratic Party for decades, around Walter Mondale, around Hubert Humphrey, around Gary Hart, who was the actual campaign manager for George McGovern. And we've demonstrated that, for example, figures like Barack Obama, who has called for preemptive military strikes in Iran and in Pakistan, his mentor was Joseph Lieberman, who is one of the most clearly demarcated neocons, although nominally a figure in the Democratic Party. As to neoliberal, that term has been used as a description of those who have supported the role of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and of the free market, particularly advocating such policies as those of NAFTA, CAFTA, the free trade agenda, in which in every country in the world, the protections for the working class, social reforms should be dismantled. The role of the government is an instrument of engendering health, education, housing, and social needs is to be dismantled. And the unbridled free market in which investment is to be dependent upon the removal of any impediment to the what we call the mad race to the sweatshop bottom will unfold. I have to say that many times people who use the term neoliberal to describe these policies, which are after all the shared policies of all components of the capitalist ruling class, whether in the Democratic or Republican Party, the main promoters of NAFTA and of the free trade agenda were Bill Clinton and Al Gore. And when NAFTA was imposed on Mexico, for example, 500,000 manufacturing jobs were lost. the main gain of the Mexican Revolution of 1910, namely the cooperatives, the taking of the huge land holdings of the oligarchy, and collectivizing them under cooperative control by poor farmers. This was dismantled and taken back, privatized, and the peasants, the farmers, were driven off the land and into the cities as a reserve army of labor, and then into the maquiladoras, or the free trade zones, where people can be paid pennies on the hour and subjected to 15-hour days with pollution and no safety protections, going back to the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution with all its barbarism. This neoliberal agenda is a capitalist agenda, and all wings of the ruling class support it. And very often, what I would call liberals and people who have been influenced by the Communist Party in its embrace of a progressive wing of the ruling class, support for liberal Democrats, so that instead of calling these the policies of capitalism today, and instead of demonstrating that this free trade agenda, this so-called fair trade agenda, is the rationale for the entire ruling class and both political parties, has been given the label neoliberal, as if there is a wing of the class alone that is pursuing these policies. And so I would say to you that both the utilization of neocon, which has a very more much more concrete reference than neoliberal, because the neoliberal politics are not associated with any particular wing of the Democratic or Republican parties. They all share in this agenda. They all promulgate this agenda. And as I mentioned, the Clinton administration, with its downsizing government and getting people off welfare, dismantled all of the support system for the most disadvantaged and exploited in our society. That's the neoliberal agenda, as it's called, but in truth, it's the capitalist agenda. So, Maya, I'm sorry.
Shall we go on to the next question?
Let's do that.
Michael?
Yes, Maya.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yes, you're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. This is WBAI FM.
Thank you very much. I've come across a website called 911scholars.org. It's about the 200 engineers and architects that say it was it was impossible for those planes to bring them down. And that's the website. If you look up 911scholars.org, you look at the right-hand corner, it says scholars. And the long website is http://patriots?911.com/engineers.html. One other thing, Meyer and Ralph, I've seen you at Marks, at St. Marks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're both wonderful. And I also like you to talk about the fact that our food supply has been contaminated. In fact, Monsanto has been using engineered seeds which don't reproduce themselves to control the food supply. There was a gentleman called Arthur Kimball, K-I-M-B-E-L-L. That was before the Senate Committee on the distribution of our food supply, and he warned us about the fact that we are being the whole country is being like victims, an experiment on the genetically engineered foods. I used to get the tomatoes from Jersey. Now you cut a tomato, and there's no seeds in them. This is genetically modified GMO seeds.
Right.
You talked about the Mexicans coming over the border. They made a deal with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization to rent out land and to flood the market with genetically engineered corn, because 80% of the corn grown in Mexico was grown by peasant tenant farmers. And that's how they got rid of the tenant farmers coming over the border. And under Reagan, with the elimination of the Price Stabilization Board, which was introduced by Henry Wallace and under the Roosevelt administration, which guaranteed the small farmer a profit, because I used to work with the Department of Agriculture, and out of a loaf of bread, it cost the farmer 6 cents to grow the wheat, and out of that 6 cents, under Reagan, they eliminated the Price Stabilization Board. That allowed corporate farms like Archer Midland, Monsanto, Gulf and Weston, to dump on the world market backed by Wall Street and the International Bank to eliminate the family farmer, which they did because now he was only getting a 3% profit on the wheat that cost him 6 cents to grow on a dollar loaf of bread.
Excuse me, this is...
No, but this is... I tell you what, I mean...
Do you have a question?
Can I say one other thing?
Yeah. Go ahead. Let us suggest what you raised because you're raising important points.
I'm also the gentleman that gave you the book on General Smedley Butler.
Right. Well,
Peter.
I remember meeting you, and I remember our discussion about Smedley Butler. Maya and I have reported on the Smedley Butler famous quotation of his statement to the American Legion when he had exposed the plot to overthrow by military coup the government of FDR, of the Franklin Roosevelt. Yes. Look, as to the 9/11 Scholars for Truth, that was an organization founded largely by Stephen Jones, the professor of physics at Brigham Young University, who has been since removed from his position because of the extraordinary work he has done on the destruction of the World Trade Centers. It's Stephen who it has established by careful peer-review scientific work that the instrument for the demolition was a chemical named thermite that when added, I believe, to sulfur creates thermite. And that alone replicates the conditions of taking steel pillars and reducing them to molten liquid, something which no hydrocarbon fire can remotely explain or do. That seminal work by Stephen Jones was done through the aegis of 9/11 scholars. I believe that Jim Fetzer was a co-founder with Stephen Jones of 9/11 Scholars for Truth. Regrettably, subsequently, some of the people who were involved in that work basically hijacked 9/11 Scholars for Truth, in my estimation, for positions which are very little grounded in factual evidence, i.e. that no planes hit the Pentagon, that space beams were responsible for the collapse of the World Trade Center towers. That's a great disservice intellectually and scientifically to this important and serious work. I regret it. I think that the scholars and scientists and architects and engineers who have addressed the physical evidence concerning the demolition of the World Trade Center have produced an absolutely remarkable record of impeccably documented work that demolishes the official fiction.
And Ralph, if I can interrupt you, in the upcoming weeks, 2 weeks from now, we'll be discussing this during the WBAI Fund Drive, particularly the work of architect Richard Gage in considering the demolition of the World Trade Center towers.
Yes, and that's a very important
piece of
work.
Stay tuned for the WBAI Fund Drive, and also we'll be offering the Gage presentation, his DVD, and also our presentations at Cooper Union on 9/11 as premiums for the WBAI Fund Drive. And again, for the issue of genetic engineering of seeds, this is an incredibly important topic that is discussed often on WBAI, and which we hope to address, too, in the coming years.
Coming weeks, actually. But let me say this one point rather quickly about the overall question you raise about the control of the food supply by Archer Daniel Midlands and Monsanto. The basic colonial device was to destroy food self-sufficient countries in the countries, the area of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The colonial project was to destroy the self-sufficient agriculture of subject peoples and to replace it with commodities that could be exploited on the world market. So whereas the African and Indian populations were food self-sufficient prior to the colonial era, India an exporter of rice, colonialism destroyed all that and replaced it with commodity production like sugar and sisal and coffee and tea. You can't eat those things. You can only speculate on them in a commodities market. That's the essence of the colonial project, which is to confer market conditions upon populations to be subjugated, cheap labor, and exploitable resources. The continuation of that is that in all parts of the world where people are hungry and starving and where their own capacity to develop an abundance of food has been destroyed by imperialism, the capitalist conglomerates that control food production have flooded markets with food that is genetically modified and altered. Much of processed food is itself toxic and highly larded with chemicals. That's part of the destruction of an organic and natural food production, which is in the interest of people as opposed to the at the service of profit. But the conglomerates that dominate the world food supply destroy all natural indigenous food production in order to impose their modified and altered and chemically larded food alternatives. And in regard to the survival of people, their life expectancy, their health, this has direct bearing on systemic disease, as it does on exploitation and immiseration. Archer Daniels Midlands and the food companies are intimately linked to the drug companies and the chemical companies and the creation of constant pharmaceuticals that are toxic in our bodies. Many of the people who have broadcast on WBAI have given particular attention to these issues, but they are at their center and at their heart a function of the capitalist state's relentless destruction of people's ability to produce for their own need and to control democratically the object of their labor, the purpose of their labor, the purpose of our work, so that what we produce and what we create is deployed for our well-being as opposed for the profit of the few.
Well put, Ralph, and let's go to our last question in the closing minutes of Taking Aim. Hello, you're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. This is Taking Aim, and you're on WBAI FM.
Thank you so much. Can you go into the current police commissioner, Ray Kelly? I know he was with trained Aristide's police force. But how does he fit into this whole matrix that you're talking about? And I'll go over the air. Thank you so much.
That's
Thank
a very
you,
good
Ray,
question.
Ralph, this is something I know you're an expert at addressing.
Well, let me say, first of all, that Kelly operates a virtual clandestine and parallel secret police under the aegis of the New York Police Department that surveils and spies on people and monitors them and creates lists for potential detention across the greater New York area. We have made reference to that done programming on that, but Kelly has a particular relationship to the enforcement arm of imperialism. When the mass movement in Haiti, which opposed the Duvaliers and overthrew both Baby Papa Doc and eventually Baby Doc, resulting in a series of military regimes. The mass movement then effected a general strike in Haiti, as you may recall. And the U.S. imperialism was very reluctant to allow an election to unfold. Each time there would be an election planned, they would unleash the Tonton Macoute and the Zanglan Do, the terror squads of the secret police in Haiti, who would murder and dismember and disappear people and attack any polling station and any gathering of people to mobilize in defense of basic rights in the slums of the Haitian cities. The mass movement created a candidate in Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Titide, who presided over a church in an impoverished part of Port-au-Prince. But what's interesting about this is that immediately what the United States did, and Jimmy Carter was one of its instruments, was to bring the former ambassador, the former figure in charge of the Strategic Hamlet program in Vietnam, to Haiti as its ambassador. And Alvin Adams basically said to Aristide, "We will keep the troops in the barracks and allow this election to proceed, and you will implement the policies of the International Monetary Fund." And that is exactly what unfolded. The most severe austerity measures ever inflicted upon the Haitian masses occurred under the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Even the policies of Marc Bazin, who had been the actual employee of the International Monetary Fund and who the capitalists, the U.S., tried to run as a candidate, but he had so little base of support that they had to abandon the idea. He would have gotten no votes at all. Bazin himself considered that the policies that Aristide had agreed to impose were too severe. It's a measure of the assault upon the Haitian masses, and when the people were demoralized, and when the people were demobilized, when the institutions that had been mass institutions generating the general strike had been taken out of function, that's when they removed Aristide, because his services were no longer needed. Raymond Kelly was then brought in. Raymond Kelly was brought in when they returned Aristide on U.S. bayonets to Port-au-Prince. Raymond Kelly was the police figure who organized and integrated all of the terror apparatus of Tonton Macoute and Zanglan Do into a police under the government that was again now with the color of official, formal authority unleashed against the population. Raymond Kelly is a death squad, torture expert figure in Haiti, and of course his function in the United States is to lay the groundwork for precisely those procedures that we have seen unleashed not only against the Haitian masses, but against the population of Latin America with the dirty war in Argentina. The School of the Americas training all the torture perpetrators, the generals and the secret police, that which unfolded in Chile, that which unfolded in Uruguay, that which unfolded in Brazil, that which was done in Central America with the death squads of Daubuisson. All of that is part of the apparatus of imperial control. Raymond Kelly is a primary administrator of that sort of thing. That's what he was doing in Haiti, and essentially that's his role in New York City as well.
We have time quickly for one brief question.
In fact, we don't. We have time to wrap up and have you say good night.
Well, let me say this, Michael. I had wanted to make reference, and I'm sorry that I leave it to the last minute, brothers and sisters. I want to call your attention to two things. On October 4th, Maya and I will be speaking in Sacramento for the longshore workers, because longshore workers have been brutalized by the police there in a crackdown on attempts of workers to organize for their rights, to organize against the assault upon the docks under the rubric of national security. And there will be a major conference in San Francisco called Labor Direct Action to Stop the War, in which we will be leading a particular discussion on the on the relationship of the Middle East to the crackdown on labor rights in the United States.
And also on the repressive apparatus of the state.
Yes. This is the working class resistance that we call for, that we're engaged in trying to build, as we did during the Milling Worker March. We ask you to go to the website of Labor Direct Action Against the War. The transport workers, the Teamsters, and the longshore workers are directly involved in this. From our perspective, brothers and sisters, as we said at the time we spoke at Cooper's Union over the anniversary of 9/11 in New York just recently, it's not about going mainstream. It's about going to Main Street, brothers and sisters, organizing the mass of our people for a struggle to remove this criminal capitalist system from its control over our lives.
This has been Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, as all our programs over the past 6 years, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We want to thank Michael G. Haskins again for his wonderful engineering. We want to thank Mark Bilk for maintaining our website and making sure each and every one of you has the access to the archive.
A special thanks to those who called in. We really appreciate your support. We appreciate your devotion to WBAI and your constant expression of support for Taking Aim. We look forward to seeing you each time we're in New York. Please continue to go to St. Mark's Church and to support the 9/11 Truth Movement. Continue, brothers and sisters, in the struggle.
I'd like to remind each and every one of you that next week the WBAI Fund Drive starts. Now is the opportunity to support WBAI.